old one. Stop by, register for only $15, and then take out an instrument at any time for free. Joe's Mill is located at the Tet Center on the lower floor in Unit 110. Visit joesmill.org for more information.
Good evening, it is 5 p.m. and this is Today in YGK on CFRC 101.9 FM, broadcasting from Lower Carruthers Hall on Queen's Campus in Kingston, Ontario. Today in YGK is brought to you by CFRC's news collective, Christina Laurie, Jesse Bell, Lauren Tucker, Dinah Jansen, and Paige Lang. CFRC's news programming is made possible by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. I'm CFRC's broadcast journalist, Christina Laurie, and here are your local news headlines.
At their last meeting, Council voted to provide $300,000 to support the city's first inclusive playground, set to be built in the Rideau Heights District. Over the last year, community members have come together to form the Inclusive Play Project, working with Extend a Family and a number of other organizations, in response to a lack of inclusive and accessible playgrounds in the city. Inclusive Play Project representatives shared evidence of this gap found in a survey the group conducted recently.
We've also recently completed an online survey where we had almost 200 responses. Throughout that survey, we found that 98% of people who responded felt that Kingston playgrounds currently do not meet our community's needs. 98% also said that they did not feel that Kingston playgrounds were inclusive to all. 85% said that they did not feel that our playgrounds currently address the age span of 0 to 12 years, which is what is currently stated.
They also shared some of the most prevalent feedback they received from community members.
On our survey, we also had hundreds of responses that were added to the questions that we asked. I'd just like to take a moment to share a couple with you. One of them stated, "The lack of inclusive play spaces isolated my daughter from her peers and has caused long-term mental health and social difficulties. If she had been able to continue enjoying her friends after she began using a wheelchair, she would likely not have the struggles as significantly as she does." We also heard from a number of families who indicated that the current Kingston parks do not meet the needs of families who have multiple children at different ages and stages and abilities. I think one of the things that we noticed in a lot of the responses with it is that there are a lot of small parkette type places throughout Kingston. And while that makes it so that it's easy to get to one, people are finding that there isn't the play value in terms of wanting to stay for a longer period of time, or if you have children of multiple different ages, there aren't things there that are interesting for all of them. And so I think that really kind of struck us in terms of how do you find to develop a space that not only meets the needs for not one age group or ability, but kind of how do you find a way that people can play together and want to stay.
In addition to classic features of a playground like slides and monkey bars, an accessible playground would include features like rubberized surfacing, ramps, and a wheelchair rocker. The project has already received an outpouring of support from the community over the last few months, with close to $200,000 already being raised by Inclusive Play Project volunteers before coming before council last week. Prior to the council meeting, Inclusive Play Project volunteers gathered before City Hall and were even joined by some councillors sporting Inclusive Play Project shirts to show their support.
When we first pitched this idea, it started as a park, and then it became a fundraising campaign. And now what we have on our hands is very clearly a movement that grows by the day, and we are so excited to be a part of it.
Councillors unanimously approved the motion to provide $300,000 from the Municipal Capital Reserve Fund for partial funding of the Inclusive Playground project. The city also provided public land at Shannon Park and will be conducting maintenance of the structure when it is complete.
Isn't this great to see a community project that started a year ago and look how much progress they have made? I'm humbly urging everyone in this council to endorse this tonight. Think of what addition this would make to Kingston, and that we're really starting a kind of new park that could be a pilot for all other parks in the area.
With the project having an estimated budget of $1.5 million, the Inclusive Play Project is continuing to raise funds. They currently have $650,000 in grant requests pending approval and additional grant applications in progress. There are also high hopes that more of these structures will be built around the city after this milestone is complete.
We don't want this to be the only park. Given the incredible success of the fundraising and just the response from the community, we want to see more of these.
More information about the Inclusive Play Project can be found on their website. A new study released in Kingston warns that Ontario's hospital workers are in, quote, deep turmoil, as working conditions become increasingly detrimental to their well-being. In January, QB's Ontario Council of Hospital Unions, OCHU, presented the worrying findings of a poll amongst Kingston hospital workers, revealing that 43% of staff say they dread going to work and 90% lack confidence in the government's plan to improve public health care. Seeking the story behind statistics like these consistent across the province, researchers Dr. Margaret Keith, Dr. James Brophy, and OCHU QB President Michael Hurley conducted a qualitative study. Dr. Brophy and Hurley held a conference in Kingston City Hall to share their findings. The study, entitled Running on Empty, is based on 26 interviews with QB hospital workers, including nurses, personal support workers, and clerical staff. It was also supported by a poll surveying 775 hospital workers, including those working in Kingston. The presentation of the study started with grim excerpts directly from the interviews.
You think it can't get any worse, and it just got worse. I was going through increasing panic attacks before work, crying before I got out of the car. I loved going to work when I first started. Now, I dread it.
Seeing the system, the way it is, I'm getting scared to get sick myself. Do I really want to come to my own facility? The exterior looks fine, but on the inside, everything's falling apart.
They've cut me up into pieces. They spread me so thin that I don't have the time to provide the level of care that I would love to provide. So, I just do what I can. That's where the pressure comes in. And the anxiety and the guilt and the feelings that I should have done more, but I can't. I can only do so much. And then with the issues that we have at work and the concern about patient neglect and the physical part of the job is so draining, my job is killing me.
It's embarrassing to say I don't have the compassion that I used to have. I am not at all the nurse I wanted to be. We all recognize that it's hard for patients too. This is not the kind of health care they deserve.
The accompanying survey revealed 70% of Kingston hospital workers who answered reported struggling with anxiety. Feelings of stress and frustration were expressed across the board by nurses, cleaners, and administrative workers alike. Dr. Brophy had the following to say on the matter at the press conference releasing the findings.
You can see that sense of, you know, I can't do the job that I want to do, and every day I go home and I feel like I failed. I'm not the nurse that I wanted to be. And that even included cleaners, for instance, who say they couldn't keep the rooms clean. They are doing more work with less, which means that they're not doing their jobs properly and so on. And so, you know, they started fearing that, you know, someone would get sick and get an infection due to their inability to do their job properly. Clerical workers, administrative workers that deal with the public and organize, you know, procedures and so on, facing all kinds of frustration and anger from the public because they can't get their MRI, they can't get the cancer treatment they want, they can't get their dialysis, and feeling their understanding, but at the same time being at the other end of that really abuse.
Violence against healthcare workers was also a largely discussed piece of the findings in the study, contributing to the feelings of stress, frustration, and hopelessness. Both in the study and the presentation, the authors noted the gendered aspect of this piece, with the majority of Ontario's hospital workers being women and the violence in the workplace reflecting the greater issue of increasing violence against women. Both Dr. Brophy and Hurley spoke to this as well.
We started off looking at the issue of violence, which was concealed from us. We didn't know that violence was an issue in healthcare, and now healthcare has become arguably one of the most dangerous and violent workplaces anywhere. And of course, you can't disconnect that from the fact that 85% of healthcare workers are women, and so much of what you hear seems like violence against women in society. When we did the interviews with healthcare workers, it was one story after another about physical attacks ones that cause serious, in some cases, people literally couldn't go back to work. They were so badly injured, punched in the face, kicked, thrown, had their head thrown through a wall.
Disfigured with a fork.
Yes.
Like that.
I'm trying to use a curve here. I had never heard anything like it. Margaret, Keith, and I, after we would do focus groups, saying, what the heck did we just hear here? Like, this is unbelievable. And nobody knows about this. And of course, that's when we found out about this whole thing of silencing and the fear of talking publicly about this.
In the study, workers were also asked their thoughts on the causes of the deterioration of their work environment. Workers responded understaffing, deregulation, underfunding, and privatization as being at the root of the issue, with Ontario being particularly challenged with 18% less hospital staff compared to the rest of Canada and the lowest per-person hospital spending of any province.
But Ontario, in every metric, is below the Canadian average. Whether it's nurse-to-patient ratios, whether it's beds to, portions of the population. In every single metric, Ontario fares worse than Canada, and Canada is now falling farther and farther behind.
You've got a great example right here in Kingston. You used to have two hospitals with two functioning emergency rooms. Now you've got one.
The study concludes stating that measures to moderate workloads across the hospital workforce, like nurse-to-patient ratios, are urgently required, and warning that the staffing crisis will continue to worsen without intervention. However, with previous studies not receiving any response when sent to provincial government representatives, Hurley expressed his doubts.
I don't want to be cynical, but I'm not hopeful. Based on the fact that all the other studies we responded to, I'm not that optimistic, but we're hoping.
Once again, that was OQP President Michael Hurley and researcher Dr. James Brophy, co-authors along with Dr. Margaret Keith of Running on Empty. This has been Christina Laurie with CFRC News, supported by the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative.
Christina, here's your arts and culture news for today. Beginning September 3rd and running until the 14th at the Union Gallery is Home Again, Queen's Fine Art Alumni Exhibit. Marking 55 years of fine art education at Queen's, this exhibition of visual artwork from fine arts and arts education alumni will be a showcase, celebration, and expression of the hopes for the future of the program. This exhibition includes work from over 70 alumni and is free for the public to peruse during open hours in the main space. Exhibition hours may vary, and you can learn more at uniongallery.queensu.ca. Continuing this month at the TED until August 31st will be Contemplating Glaciers, A Dialogue, a solo exhibition from Jan Kabatov, curated by Jessica Turner. This exhibition will include photography, sculpture, paintings, video, audio, and even a virtual reality element using the Oculus headset and footage from a documentary on the melting of the Athabasca Glacier, currently in production from this creative team. All ages are welcome to peruse this exhibition in the TED Center Gallery, and it is free to do so, though exhibition hours may vary. There's also upcoming workshops on topics like Indian folk art, scrapbooking, monoprinting, and watercolor in September at the TET, as well as new events and exhibitions all the time. And to learn more, you can visit tetcenter.org. Registration for fall term programming at the Kingston School of Art is now open, including programs for youth and adults and workshops. This includes adult classes in drawing, fiber and textile arts, mixed media, painting, printmaking, and sculpture, and youth programs for kids ages 6 to 16, as well as families. There are also a variety of 1 and 2 day workshops available for registration now. For more information and to register, visit ksoa.info. At Modern Fuel Art Gallery, in partnership with the Union Gallery, is the Twofold Artist in Residence program, led by co-directors Jill Glatt and Berlin Reed. This program provides an opportunity for local BIPOC artists to dive into their practices, collaborations, and discussions while having access to designated workspaces, professional development and mentorship, communal events, and a studio visit platform. This year's artists in residence are Shanique Pert, Alicia Udvari, Shamara Pert, and Samara Khan, who worked at the Union Gallery in July and Modern Fuel Art Gallery in August. Fest. Also coming up at Modern Fuel are three new exhibitions beginning September 14th and running until November 9th. In the main gallery is In the Shadow of the Sun by regional artist Alyssa Scott. In the State of Flux Gallery, A Common Babble by extra-regional artist Nikita FK. And in the Window Gallery, Artwork Care Work, Portraits of Artists / Mothers by extra-regional artist Claire Drummond. For more information, visit modernfuel.org. And this is your last week to catch summer events at Springer Market Square. On Tuesday evening, Salsa in the Square runs from 6:30 to 7:30 p.m. Enjoy a free beginner class, then hit the open dance floor until 10 p.m. Also this Wednesday evening, enjoy Swingin' Summer, a live music throwback to the era of romantic, joyful, and jazzy songs from 7 to 8 p.m. in Springer Market Square. And this Friday evening, Springer Market Square hosts Kickin' It Country from 7 to 8 p.m. featuring live local country music. For more on these events, visit downtownkingston.ca. Every Monday at Daft Brewing, Bon Evans hosts Music Trivia Mondays at 7 p.m. Put your music knowledge to the test in four more rounds of trivia, whether you're going it solo or in a team with clips, questions, and more. The winning team walks away at the end of the night with a $50 gift card and bragging rights, so be sure to check it out for a Monday night of music and fun. This is also your last week to catch Movies in the Square in Springer Market Square. Lilo and Stitch starts at dusk on August 29th. Be sure to mark your calendar now and bring your blankets, chairs, and bug spray to experience your favorite films for free this summer under the stars. Coming up at Kingston's Independent Cinema, The Screening Room, you can catch special screenings of 1963's The Birds on August 26th, 27th, 28th, and 29th as part of the Summer Alfred Hitchcock Presents series, and the 40th anniversary screenings of Purple Rain on August 27th, 28th, and 29th. As well, more shows have been added to Cat Video Fest 2024, a fundraiser where 10% of all ticket sales will be donated to Kingston Animal Rescue, featuring compilations of the latest and best cat videos of the internet on the big screen. New showtimes will run on August 26th and 29th. There are also new arrivals and special screenings all the time, so be sure to check back at screeningroomkingston.com for all of your cinema adventures. That's all I've got for you on Arts Desk today. Now I'll turn it over to Jesse Bell at the Sports Desk.
This is Jesse Bell from the CFRC Sports Desk, and this is your sports report for Monday, August 26th, 2024. It was a disappointing start to the 2024 football season for the Queens Gaels as they were on the road in Windsor over the weekend. Scoring began early in the first quarter as the Windsor Lancers tallied a 12-yard touchdown run from quarterback Danny Skelton. Queens would respond at the start of the second quarter with a 20-yard Tyler Mullen field goal, which culminates a 11-play, 83-yard drive for the Gaels. Windsor would rally back with a quick touchdown to Giovanni Cunningham from Danny Skelton, but the Gaels would score 10 points before the half to make it a 14-13 ball game, with Queens' first touchdown of the season coming on a 54-yard pass from Alex Freakin to Matt Camillo. Windsor would score a 16-yard safety at the start of the third quarter, making it 16-13. They would add a Daniel Hector 7-yard touchdown from Danny Skelton to make it 23-13, and then a second safety for the Lancers put them up 25-13 at the start of the fourth quarter. The Gaels would eventually maintain some momentum and score on an Alex Vreeken 1-yard quarterback sneak, and then Tyler Mullen would tally a rouge on the kickoff to lower the gap to a 4-point deficit. Ultimately, the Gaels would be unable to overcome this 4-point deficit, losing to the Lancers by a score of 25-21. This was a disappointing start for the Gaels, but a much improved result over last year, where they also lost to the Windsor Lancers on the road, albeit by a much more lopsided score of 25-9. The Queens defense played very well, generating turnovers and keeping their team in the game, but the offense did struggle, tallying 4 interceptions, 3 of which went to defensive back Robert Springer. The Gaels will play on Saturday, August 31st at Richardson Memorial Stadium against the McMaster Marauders in the Queens home opener. Pre-game show sponsored by Something in the Water Brewing is scheduled for 5:45 p.m., 6 p.m. scheduled kickoff time. This is Jesse Bell signing off and wishing you all nothing but the best. For 142 years, the Queens Gaels have called Kingston home. The tricolor has become as synonymous with the city as the limestone upon which it was built. But that love, admiration, and respect comes with a powerful commitment. A pledge to protect this house.
On Saturday, August 31st, the Queens Gaels will host the McMaster Marauders for their home opener at Richardson Memorial Stadium. Kickoff is scheduled for 6 p.m. and CFRC's coverage will begin at 5:45.
It's time for CFRC's concert and events calendar. Have an event you'd like covered? Reach out through CFRC.ca today. On Monday, August 26th, drop into the club at the RCHA for Jazz Monday. The jazzy afternoon show with Inner Harbor Jazz is the best way to spend your afternoon. The tunes play from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. Admission is $5. As part of their monthly musical residency, the Cove Inn hosts solo artist Jared McGrath. With the mix of looping effects creating soundscapes, Gerald McGrath is giving you a relaxing afternoon show from 5 to 8 p.m. Admission is by donation. The Spire hosts one of YouTube's most popular comics, Steve Hofstetter. Prepare for a night of laughs and fun from 7:30 to 9 p.m. For tickets, go to stevehofstetter.com. Since 2000, dancers have been heading over to Newlands Pavilion in McDonald Park for summer swing dancing. The dancing runs from 6 to 8 p.m. and is free to attend. On Tuesday, August 27th, Tom Savage and friends host Tom's Tuesday Happy Hour and Jam. Head down to the club at the RCHA from 4 to 7 p.m. to enjoy a drink and watch the show. Admission is free. The Cove Inn hosts solo rock and roll singer-songwriter Kentucky, supported by the Family Band. Rock out and enjoy the show from 5 to 8 p.m. Admission is free. Head down to Fernand's Family Farm for acoustic guitar night with the acoustic guitar stylings of Anton Dufour, Adrian Bellew, and Van Larkins. Doors at 7 p.m. and admission is $30. Come to the oldest market in Ontario at Kingston Market Square. The market features local produce, artisans, and more from 8:30 a.m. to 4 p.m. The market runs Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday. Spice up your Tuesday with free salsa in the square. Head down to Kingston Market Square from 6:30 p.m. to 10 p.m. for a free salsa dance lesson followed by open dance floor until 10 p.m. No experience necessary. On Wednesday, August 28th, join Sean McCullough and friends for Wings and Tunes on the patio at Cove Inn. Grab some piping hot wings and enjoy the show from 5:30 to 8:30 p.m. Admission is free. Swing by Spearhead Brewery for $5 dates covering tunes from your favorite artists including Blue Rodeo, Neil Young, Mumford & Sons, and the Lumineers. The show is from 7 to 10 p.m. and is free to attend. Head down to Springer Market Square for Swingin' Summer featuring Dixie Plus One. Listen to the romantic songs of yesteryear from 7 to 8 p.m. The show is free to attend. Fresh Food Market Pop-Up is giving you local produce and pre-made food that won't break the bank. The Fresh Food Pop-Up is at Rideau Heights Community Center from 2 to 5 p.m. this Wednesday. The market is in local community centers around Kingston Wednesday to Saturday. For times and locations, check out freshfoodmkt.ca. Head over to Musicki Cafe and Whiskey Bar for Musicki Live Drawing, an afternoon of unrestricted life drawing. For $5, enjoy the relaxing vibes and bring your own supplies for some inspiration. Live music starts at 8 p.m., so grab a drink and enjoy. On Thursday, August 29th, the club at the RCHA hosts Beats Workin', the last Thursday of the month tradition. The show plays from 7 to 10 p.m. and is just $5 to attend. This Thursday, head down to Hotel Wolf Island for alt-country band Cody Allen James & Co. The tunes play from 7 to 10 p.m. Admission is free. Enjoy a night of laughs and fun at the Cove Inn featuring stand-up comedian and actor Tom Green. The show is from 7 to 10:30 p.m. and tickets are $90, including dinner and a show. Get ready to sing your heart out. Daft Brewing is hosting Drag Sing-Along Roulette with special host Rowena Way. All performances are chosen by you. The show is from 7:30 to 9:30 p.m. and the event is free to attend. Head down to Kingston Market Square for Movies in the Square. This week is Disney classic Lilo and Stitch. The movie starts when the sun goes down, so 9 to 10:30 p.m. The movie is free, but don't forget extra cash for snacks. On Friday, August 30th, every Friday at Blue Martini, Christopher Jackson and friends play your favorite covers as well as some fun originals. The show is from 7 to 10 p.m. Admission is free. Enjoy a happy hour TGIF with Dan Chabrineau at the club at the RCHA. Enjoy tunes and a good time from 4:30 to 6:30 p.m. Admission is free. Stay and grab a drink for the Calorie Night Band from 8 to 11 p.m. Tickets are just $5. Head over to the Mansion for Triple Header North by North, The Backsteps, and Monarch. Rock out, grab a drink, and enjoy the show for $15. Doors at 7 p.m. The Merchant hosts local rock band Luscious with special guest Piner. The show runs from 10:30 p.m. to 1 a.m. and the show is $12 to attend. Hang out, grab a drink, and have a good time. Head over to Hotel Wolf Island for a groovy night of dancing and fun with Mindflowers DJ featuring vinyl DJ LK. The psychedelic set is sure to get you dancing from 5 to 7 p.m. The event is free to attend. Prepare for a dazzling night of cabaret at Carlo Estates Winery with dinner theater, live musical performances, and witty banter. The show is from 6 to 9 p.m. Bring your best Brooks and Dunn song and head down to the Buckle for country karaoke. Karaoke's from 9 p.m. to midnight. Grab a drink and have fun. On Saturday, August 31st, head down to Confederation Park for free live music. Enjoy the music from Sarah Zanibbi, Who's Here, and Nice On. The tunes play from 11:30 a.m. to 3:30 p.m. The show is for all ages. Drill Hall at Base 31 hosts Canadian rock legends Trooper and Honeymoon Suite. The show is bound to have you singing and dancing all night long. Doors are at 7 p.m. and tickets range from $79 to $169. Enjoy the beautiful view at Juniper Cafe with the soulful musical stylings of Frank Ryan. Grab a coffee and relax with the tunes from 4 to 6 p.m. The show is free to attend. Put on your best leather and bang your head at the mansion this Saturday. Hard rock groups Sons of Static, No Small Affair, and Stunseed are giving you all that rock energy. Doors at 9:30 p.m. The tickets are $20 at the door. Kingston-based duo Roderick and Bairstow are playing country, rock, and folk at the Spearhead Brewery. Grab a drink and watch the show from 7 to 10 p.m. Admission is free. Go down to the Toucan for rock band Sweet Pete and the Heat. The late night set goes from 10:30 p.m. to 2 a.m. Admission is free. Attention all university students, each week a downtown Kingston chef prepares a dish using local ingredients. Come watch the demo from 11 a.m. to 12 p.m. at Kingston Market Square. Try the dish for just $2. Head down to the Kingston Grand Theater for Boston-based stand-up comedian Gary Gulman. Get ready to laugh till you drop from 8 to 10 p.m. Go to www.kingstongrand.ca for tickets. On Sunday, September 1st, the patio at the Cove Inn presents live jazz and contemporary with Head Over Heels. The show is from 5 to 8 p.m. Admission is by donation. Head over to the Opinicon for live music on the patio with Timothy Lowton. The tunes play from 2 to 5 p.m. and the show is free to attend. Grab your yoga mat and walk down to Battery Park for free yoga in the park. Revive and rejuvenate from 10 a.m. to 11 p.m. The session is held by a local instructor. The yoga is for all ages and abilities. Get ready for back to school with Neutrogena. The Boost Bus is supplying you with all your skin and sun care needs. The bus will be parked at University Avenue and Union Street and will be up and running from 10:30 a.m. to 6 p.m. The screening room is giving you three classic movies this Sunday. At 1:20 p.m., celebrate Coraline's 15th anniversary. 4:10 p.m., comedy classic Ghostbusters. And at 6:40, Little Miss Sunshine. For tickets, go to screeningroomkingston.com. That's all for your live music and events calendar this week.
Thank you for tuning in to CFRC's local news programming. To revisit episodes of Today in YGK and hear more from some of our guests, be sure to head to our podcast network at podcast.cfrc.ca. Today in YGK is brought to you by the generous support of the Community Radio Fund of Canada under the Local Journalism Initiative, Queen's University Career Services, What'll I Wear, 732 Princess Street, and The Screening Room at screeningroomkingston.com. Be sure to stay tuned for more CFRC programming coming up next.
What'll I Wear offers the best in vintage, funky, one-of-a-kind treasures, clothing, accessories, and a fabulous selection of jewels, vintage and new. Find the cutest purse, the most dashing of hats and sunglasses, everything to complete your individual look. What'll I Wear has it all. They can dress you from top to bottom. Find your new fashion fave at What'll I Wear at 732 Princess Street in Kingston. Visit their new location and follow them on Facebook to keep up to date with what's in store at What'll I Wear.
August is Black Philanthropy Month. We're calling all active citizens to join in on this global Black Philanthropy initiative. This special fundraising effort assists the United Nations Sustainable Development Goals for Black-serving nonprofit organizations. Tackle issues close to home, from poverty to quality education, gender equality to economic growth. Individuals and businesses can participate in this fundraiser, internationally administered by Support Black Charities. Visit global-bpi.org to learn more and spread the message. Donate today at global-bpi.org.
Our house is a very, very, very fine house.
Late in the 1970s, four Kingston women got together to discuss the idea of creating a community house, a place where grassroots organizations, families, and groups could gather, a place where food could be prepared and shared, new skills could be learned, and lively discussion could be encouraged. For over 30 years, Kingston Community House has provided low-cost meeting space for hundreds of groups, allowing people to come together to learn from one another, share resources, and trade skills. As it becomes safe once again to gather in person, we look forward to providing the Kingston community with a comfortable and convenient place to reconnect with one another. Located in downtown Kingston, we operate 7 days a week. For more information on Kingston Community House and how to book, please visit kingstoncommunityhouse.org.
Good day. You're listening to Free City Radio. I'm Stefan Christophe in Montreal, and this is edition 229. On the broadcast today, we continue with our series, Capitalism's Sacrifice of Humanity. We're looking at a massively important global topic in this series. As you can tell from the title, we are trying to break down the dependency of the capitalist economic system today on having excess human populations that are essentially sacrificed, whether it's through climate and thinking about how major corporations, from oil and gas to industrial corporations, have sacrificed the environment, and that will definitely have detrimental impacts and loss of life for many communities around the world, whether it's the military-industrial complex, which views war as a framework and context for profit-making. As we've seen in Gaza over the last months, that has led to unbelievable suffering and massive casualties. So many Palestinians have lost their lives. So there's many contexts to look at this topic. This series is produced in collaboration with activist scholar Max Haven, who's the Canada Research Chair in the Radical Imagination and co-director of the Reimagining Value Action Lab, RIVAL, at Lakehead University in Ontario. On this edition, we are going to speak to Karen Wang, who is a scholar and has specifically looked at this topic in a book that's called Legal and Rhetorical Foundations of Economic Globalization, An Atlas of Ritual Sacrifice in Late Capitalism. And I thought it was great to speak with Karen about his reflections and his work looking critically at this topic. So I'm going to leave it there, and here's our conversation.
Thank you very much, and thank you for having me on this very timely forum of discussing the kind of events and affairs that I think speak both profoundly and closely to our current exigency. So I'm Karen Wang. I'm a researcher whose area of study mostly revolve around history of ideas, history of social thought, and how it intersects with international and global affairs. So I've I'm the American Council of Learned Societies fellow at Emory University. So this is a 2-year appointment, but normally I'm at Penn State School of International Affairs, and I teach basically wide and research on a wide variety of topics that touches on political communication, history of political and social thoughts, and how that relate to our current lived conditions, broadly speaking. So, that's kind of basically explains my scholarship and what I do. And so the latest book I published called the Legal and Rhetorical Foundations of Economic Globalization, it's precisely through this angle where I look at specifically the history of both the thought and practice of human sacrifice, right? Which is something that typically, if we encounter that's in academic literature, it's like Bronze Age, you know, material that's seemingly something very distant associated with past society. But I look at the structural elements of these kind of ritual practice, and how do they intersect with still the kind of political discourse of our current neoliberalism, current political economy that we find ourselves in, and what has evolved beyond that and what is still resonates, right? So I think that's basically sums up my ongoing research, yeah.
So when you talk about human sacrifice and economic systems, maybe you could break that down a bit in the current context and how that feeds into sort of cultural shorthand and also sort of the hidden elements of reality in terms of like the impacts of economic systems today. And, you know, I mean, to put it plainly, how that leads to mass death. I mean, it seems like a very intense thing to say, but there's some truth in it.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And in academic conferences, usually that's the first question I get. How in the world these two human sacrifice and say capitalism or globalization, right? How do they intersect? So the ritual taking of things as of human value, right, including could be wealth, land, access, but including the taking of human lives, has been really continuously practiced for as long as human civilization, at least sedentary civilization, have existed. For instance, capital punishment, right? That's one of the oldest form of human sacrifice that's continuously practiced from ancient to the present day, especially, right? As American, we still retain that ancient ritual. But that's not where human sacrifice in contemporary society stops, far from being it. For example, 20th century American social psychologist Eric Fromm famously observed in his study of social psychology of violence, right? He used the case of World War I as an example, where he noted how large percentage of young men in those warring nations, Europe, were killed, and surely they were loved by their parents too, and yet, especially for those who are mostly deeply imbued in the traditional concept of nationalism back then, and for many of their loved ones, right, the parents' side, they did not even hesitate for many of them, right, especially the patriotic ones, to send them their children to death. And those young men who died in the trenches were celebrated as heroes, right? And the scale of World War I, World War II, the deaths involved far exceeded than those so-called human sacrifices, even the massive scale ones that we've seen in, say, pre-Columbia Mesoamerica or Bronze Age China. And that's why, for example, another more contemporary social theorist, René Girard, right, famously observed that sacrifice is really the crucial and most fundamental rights of all systems that give structure to human society. And language, kingship system, our totems and taboos, code of etiquette, and most importantly, civil instructions. So that's why it's very important to remember that ritual sacrifice were far more than just simple acts of religious devotion or mystic practices. Right? In the historical evidence in my research, right, shows that ample evidence suggests that sacrifices were performed in part as quote-unquote crisis management institutions, those most persistent and widespread being the practice of scapegoating the vulnerable segments of populations as quote-unquote apotropaic rites. That means getting rid of the most expendable population to deliver the society from economic crisis, whether it's natural or socially induced. So we have large-scale human sacrifice in Bronze Age China more than 3,000 years ago, and more recently in pre-Columbian Mesoamerican city-states, ample evidence, right, showing that they really only took place during periods of severe food shortages, usually caused by war or crop failure. And more recent works by Swiss historian Wolfgang Bainer also found this clear connection between periods of food insecurity in early modern Europe with the rise, right, the intensive waves of witch hunting practices in both the early modern Europe and its colonies, for example. So as society evolved, really, human sacrifice did not disappear in any way, arguably intensified in many ways, given examples of the two great wars and the emergence of nuclear weapon and so on and so forth. But what changed, right? It's not the ritual of human sacrifice, but what changed is the rhetoric we used to justify human sacrifice. So we evolve, as society evolved, we erect new sacred, quote-unquote, totems that demand extraordinary sacrifices for the, quote-unquote, abstract, some kind of form of great good, right? That's why we get from God to God kings to the nation, then to the notion of free market, right? Freedom, free market. That's the stage that we are currently in, the totem that we're currently have under the neoliberalism. So again, it's a moment of crisis, really, where ritual sacrifice enters the central stage, especially in moments where the sweeping material promise, right, of these totemic ideals failed to deliver. Then, right, the society and its especially ruling class, which benefits from a given mode of political economy, we're trying to figure out, especially in this kind of times when the promised good material life cannot be delivered, then how to convince the sacrificing of these vulnerable peoples in this extraordinary means, and nowadays too, through the destruction of waste and pollution, right? To make them appear as natural, inevitable, or even virtuous. So as modern forms of ritual sacrifice, that's why we no longer use the old languages of religion, right? But economic, legal, and administrative rhetoric takes the central place in justifying the mode of the kind of massive layoffs that we see, right? The massive, measures that led to the redistribution of wealth, especially during crisis, that the poorest 90-95% of the population would see their income and lived quality of life decrease, while we see the further accumulation of wealth in the amount of population that really owns these kind of fixed capital goods and means of generating wealth. Yes, so that's that's getting a long-winded answer, but I just want to make sure to unpack that so that we see that this kind of a clear structural connection between these seemingly disjointed concepts.
Let's dig down a bit on this structural connection, because I think there's conceptions of quote-unquote civilization today that are sort of rolled out. We can see, for example, with what's happening in Gaza, the mask has fallen in a lot of ways in terms of like assumptions about the capacity of Western institutions to protect human life. This is just on a factual level not happened in Gaza. Palestinians are being killed at extraordinary rates. And it's clear if we see a lot of media coverage that there's a presentation and a justification that this mass killing is somehow necessary. It's unbelievable to even say it that way, but it's a fact. And I think, you know, conceptually speaking, right, and what you've been sharing is really important, because I feel like today there's this assumption of like this sort of bedrock of legitimacy of civilization and a lot of institutions that are understood to be guiding economic and political systems. But we keep seeing this relapse into similar modes of sacrifice that are seen as historical or are historicized or even romanticized in some contexts, if we're talking about cinema, but that's another conversation. But maybe you could just sort of dig down into the ways that there is a through line between those histories you're talking about that are often presented as quote unquote savage and the present.
Thank you very much. And you raised a very interesting point. And it's a point that that's why arguably this is especially the kind of sudden intensification of global violence. And again, for those experts that kind of do quantitative tracking of these kind of incidents, so there is a clear, it's not just a media sphere that amped up the reporting, the in terms of this classical war and conflict between peoples and nations, there has been a sudden uptick, especially since 2010s. So it's not quite just last couple of years, but since 2010s, there's this very concerning uptake, and just over the past few years, even drastically increase in the intensity, right? You mentioned the war in Gaza, and immediately preceding that, right, the war in Eastern Europe, right? The kind of imageries that you really haven't seen in Europe since the previous World War. So, interestingly speaking, this is almost a kind of departure, that the pattern that we're seeing from the kind of neoliberal mode of human sacrifice and reversion back to arguably a much more classical manifestation of human sacrifice, right? From almost harkens back to the age of the early modern age of national rise of nationalism and the first wave of industrialization. And this is also a kind of sign too, if we discuss with social and economic historians, a sign of you know, this kind of almost overused term, late capitalism, where the one we're entering this because the intrinsic contradictions of the political economy has reached a point where there's basically, well, to put it in an extremely crude term, there's so much globe has quote unquote industrialized to the point where there's not much more further. That much more under-industrialized population that can further exploit to move up this kind of a scheme of exploitation that kind of runs its course. And that's why increasingly suddenly we see the re-emergence rhetoric of the paleo rhetoric of hate, right? The hate that is much more reminiscent in a time that's pre-given the current neoliberal period, where suddenly the violence not only erupt with this kind of large-scale total war between the entire society, not just this professionalized war that is, right, that's more familiar in the 1990s and early 2000s, or back to this kind of mode of total war between whole nations and populations, but also in a much more visible way. Because in your question, you mentioned about this interesting kind of phrase, right? The textile industry in Bangladesh, which sounds very banal, right? Which belies tens of thousands of people dead from industrial under regulated industrial conditions, and many more, many times more, with life debilitating injuries and sufferings from just mere couple of decades of outsourcing the textile industry to countries like Bangladesh and Pakistan, of which fuels are, right, in America and Canada and Western Europe, the fast fashion, first quote-unquote first world lifestyle, right? And if you look at the deaths, right, in this kind of much more boring dystopia of Bangladesh textile, or right, the industry, which is just a micro slice of the larger pie, right? And the number is not only involves greater amount of people being sacrificed and dead, and also with kind of debilitating injury, but it's much more hidden, right? And so. That's the interesting part of the dynamic that I'm seeing, is that because of this new mode of this post-World War II mode of administrative quote-unquote boring and hidden mode of a human sacrifice to sustain this kind of transporting of wealth from less developed to the more developed economic core. It's running at its course that we are start seeing, right, this more classical display of this almost 19th and early 20th century warfare that erupts again, and then leaders to increasingly going reverting back to the older collective memory of hate in maintaining or hanging on to the power relations and the rule and their political rule. Yes.
Well, I really appreciate what you said, because it seems also that in recent years, social movements for generations and you know, different struggles around the world have pushed for a deeper analysis around colonialism, systemic racism, economic injustice, systemic poverty. And in recent years, there is a growing awareness of these issues. You know, we've seen that exploding in terms of people wanting to join demonstrations, you know, whether it's around police violence, joining Black Lives Matter, a few years earlier, Occupy Wall Street. Unfortunately, there isn't the institutions to challenge power, but there is a lot of interest to join social movements to critique these systems. The contradictions are huge. And maybe we could just end to hear on your reflections about sort of, there's a mythology here, right? Like one of them that we hear repeated a lot by leaders that are seen as progressive. Let's take Justin Trudeau from Canada, or even, you know, somebody like Macron in France, who's seen as not as severe as the Front National, for example. But they do adhere to this sort of ideology of limitless growth, which of course has immeasurable consequences for the climate, and also speaks into, folds into a lot of what you are addressing in terms of the necessity of the hidden sacrifice of the neoliberal era that now is expanding into like open sacrifice and war. Any thoughts about this? Thank you.
Thank you. I'm so glad you mentioned this kind of very prevailing mythology that is in part of neoliberalism, that's in part built on this truth, but it's told in a way that's very misleading. And yet, even among the, politically kind of those who are politically discontent against neoliberalism, I think currently it's not adequately addressed, right? This argument that it's like you said, echoed by earlier, right, folks like Milton Friedman, right, by Margaret Thatcher, Ronald Reagan, now, right, we hear by Justin Trudeau, by Emmanuel Macron, right, the defenders of neoliberalism, that, right, look, peace, first of all, after World War II, we haven't had a world war, which is increasingly, right, not really tenable. But second argument is, look, prosperity, right? Billions of people in China, in India, have lifted out of prosperity. And that's the perhaps the most persuasive argument, at least to the global audience, these proponents of neoliberalism made. And they would show these graphs too, very elaborate graphs showing the increase of GDP, and increase of decrease of poverty. But the story is very misleading in one way, is that the story doesn't explain, right, this kind of seemingly unstoppable collective uplifting power of neoliberalism, doesn't explain the what exactly is the kind of sacrifice that's involved, because that not only shows the kind of ethical injustice, but it also actually reveals how misleading and radically unsustainable is. Because I remember back in the 1990s, it used to be China, for example, that made clothes for, because back then it was the country with abundant low-cost labor, so that and lackluster safety regulations. Then what happened? One-child policy kicked in, so children became more, quote-unquote, precious because each family only has one, and they start demanding higher pay and more safety regulation, and they too want to live like folks in Canada, in France, in US, and not just spending their life making without much of saving in textile factories, end up, if you're lucky, with repetitive motion injuries. If you're right, more likely will end up with life altering injuries and get your early retirement package. So then from early 2000s, what happened was that countries like China, Taiwan, all right, they were able to ship their quote unquote this labor intensive considered low-end manufacturing labor to even poorer countries with bigger economic population strain and even less labor regulatory processes, like Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Indonesia. And then, right, it's the downward export of these sacrificial labor that these upstream countries were able to enjoy better living. But that relies on, there's always a greater number presumption, right? This is the part that is not told, of a sacrificial labor, right? Doing these kind of low cost, high risk job, right? That produces the goods that feeds a relatively smaller number of population that is called the for quote unquote first world, developed world, or global north lifestyle. And for countries like Bangladesh, right, for countries like Pakistan, there isn't enough even poorer countries that's beneath them that they can further exploit down their labor, right? So that's the end of the line, meaning we have reached that net exploitation pyramid scheme, right? So the scheme, it doesn't take a critical observer to notice the system doesn't work, is that this kind of crisis is just like any pyramid scheme. It's intrinsic because it relies on, right, the good lifestyle relies on this exploitation of these less quote-unquote industrialized populations. And once we reach about 40 and 50% of the globe considered industrialized, the system would rapidly unravel. So that's the part of the story that I talked to many economists that they seem to understand, right? So this is on the academic sphere. I don't think there's a lack of understanding. Yet in the policy discourse, it's never the caveat, the fine print that shows that, okay, Bangladesh will not get to become, right, the U.S. because there's no further cheap labors to sacrifice down those stream.
That was a conversation with Kieran Wang, who is an author and scholar. Author published in 2020 the book Legal and Rhetorical Foundations of Economic Globalization, an Atlas of Ritual Sacrifice in Late Capitalism. And this interview is part of a mini-series that I have produced in collaboration with activist scholar Max Haven, who is the Canada Research Chair in the Radical Imagination and co-director of the Reimagining Value Action Lab Rival at Lakehead University in Ontario. The series is Capitalism, Sacrifice of Humanity. Thanks so much for tuning in. I'm Stefan Christoph. Free City Radio broadcasts weekly on CKUT 90.3 FM in Montreal on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. on CGLO 1690 a.m. also in Geogeaga, Montreal on Wednesdays at 8:30 a.m. on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg at 10:30 p.m. on Tuesdays, on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario at 11:30 a.m. on Wednesdays, on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, B.C. on Wednesdays at 9 a.m. and Saturdays at 7 a.m. on Met Radio 1280 a.m. in Toronto at 5:30 a.m. on Fridays, and now on CKCU 93.1 FM in Ottawa on Tuesdays at 2 p.m. We're also a podcast. Look us up on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search Free City Radio. Our archives are at soundcloud.com/freecityradio. I'm Stefan Christoph, and I will speak to you next week.
I'm Justin Evangelo, cancer survivor and visually impaired new program.